I thought Radio Dan only dreamt about himself.
The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Radio Dan Show, brought to you live on Talk Radio X.
Hello, everybody. My name happens to be Dan Delgado. You happen to be listening to The Radio Dan Show. We are live on Talk Radio X on a Wednesday night, or maybe it's a Thursday morning or Thursday afternoon, depending on when it is that you are hearing this particular program. Welcome one, welcome all. This is an hour where we spend our time discussing the wonder and glory of television and movies. As always, as you heard in the fantastic announcing job there, is the wonderful and lovely, the intern, Jessica. Jessica, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Hang on a second. I'm going to help you out here. Boop. There you go. All right. Try it again. Jessica, how are you doing tonight?
Maybe it's just that my microphone isn't very loud.
Oh. Jessica wants to play the game that her microphone's not loud. Okay. Go ahead. Try it now, honey.
I'm doing good.
Oh, okay. Hey, fantastic. All right, so it's a Wednesday night, and it's a rarity for us because we happen to have a guest that we're going to bring onto the show. We usually do not have a lot of guests on the show, but once in a while we're able to con someone who is nice enough to spend some time with us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And tonight that lucky person happens to be Mr. Ken Levine. Ken happens to be a sitcom writer. A veteran sitcom writer for the last 30 years. He's also been a play-by-play man in the major leagues. He's done some work. I know he works with the Dodgers these days, and I believe what he does there is right now he does a after-game show for L.A. So anyway, we're going to bring him on right now, and I believe we do have him on the line. Such an interesting career that I'm pretty excited to be talking to you, to be honest with you. You've done all kinds of things that I'm completely jealous of, because there's two things that I love.
Actually, he's turning green, like, right in front of me. It's pretty amazing.
I love...
Well, maybe you can read by him.
I love baseball, and I love sitcoms. And, Ken, you seem to have both of those markets cornered. Is that right?
Well, I've been very lucky in that I've been a writer and also a baseball announcer. And as a writer, I've gotten a chance to do shows like Cheers, which is about a baseball player. So I kind of, you know, get a lot of bang for my buck there.
Were you doing any sort of All-Star Game covering the other night?
The only covering I was doing of the All-Star Game was on my blog. I did a big All-Star feature on my blog. But since a lot of people who read my blog are people from other countries besides the United States. You know, there's a lot of people in, you know, New Zealand and Kuwait and Scotland who couldn't care less.
Did you stay up for the whole 15 innings?
Absolutely, but see, I'm on the West Coast, so it's no problem for me.
I was just about to say that. I was about to say, you know, it's probably a lot easier to stay up, you know, for those late night games when it's 3 hours early.
I'm sure. I mean, it was truly a great game, and I don't think 15 people on the East Coast saw it.
No, I don't think so. Here, you know what? Here's because I'm in South Florida. And the one thing that people kept telling me today was, yeah, did you see Dan Uggla? Yeah. Did you see him, like, have
Poor
two
Dan
errors
Uggla.
And strike
out? Poor Dan Uggla. Such a good guy.
I know,
and,
it's all you hear about
wow, did he have
AM
a terrible
right
game.
Yeah, he had a very bad All-Star game, but personally.
I mean, look, defense has never been his strong suit.
No, not at all.
And thanks to Perry Hill, who really kind of taught him how to at least be as good as he is. But he used to be a real butcher out there.
You know, personally, even though I live down here, I'm a huge Mets fan. And for me, when I was watching that game, for the portion that I was awake for, I was just thinking, boy, don't put Billy Wagner in because I know he's going to give up run. Just please don't. Just I don't know if that's because it's him and he's been prone to do that, especially over the last few weeks, or if that's just my negative Mets attitude that I have, where it's always gloom and doom. But as soon as he went in, I knew it. I said, okay, bad things are going to happen. Yeah. So let me ask Kent. How did you get started? Which came first, baseball announcing or sitcom writing?
Sitcom writing. Actually, when I got out of college, I was a top 40 disc jockey. And then I got into sitcom writing. And I did that. I'm still doing that. I always wanted to be a baseball announcer from the first time I heard Vin Scully. And... when the Dodgers came to L.A. in 1958. And so I reached my middle 30s, and I figured if I don't pursue it now, I never will. So I went to the upper deck of Dodger Stadium with a tape recorder and just began learning how to do play-by-play, just calling games into a tape recorder every night, sitting up there in the nosebleed section with all the drunks and bizarre people wearing pinwheel hats and things like that. And I did that for a couple of seasons and sent my tape around to minor league clubs and got a job with Syracuse, which is the Toronto Blue Jays AAA affiliate, and then 2 years with the New York Mets AAA affiliate in Tidewater. You should know that very well, although
Tidewater?
They're no longer in Tidewater.
No, Tidewater
and,
Tides.
And then got a job with the Baltimore Orioles. There was an opening, and I sent in my tape, and I got the job.
Now, working as a play-by-play guy, I mean, that's a lot of dates a year. How did you end up doing that and having the sitcom career at the same time?
Well, fortunately, I was with bad teams, so I never had to worry
no
about October.
Okay. Summer only. I got
right.
it.
And the TV season is basically from August to March, so I really was able to sort of, you know, dovetail the two, and I would be writing scripts during the season while announcing baseball.
No kidding. That's amazing.
And just send them in, yeah.
Now, focusing on the sitcom writing, where did you first start in? How did you first start writing for television programs?
I met my partner in an Army Reserve unit. Neither of us had written anything. My partner, David Isaacs. Mm-hmm. And at the time, like I said, I was a disc jockey, and, you know, I was getting fired every 6 months when, you know, new program directors would come in, the life of a radio star. And so at one point I called him up and I said, hey, I want to try writing a script. You want to write with me? And he said, okay. And we had to buy a copy of an Odd Couple TV script, you know, at a bookstore in Hollywood, just to even see what the format looked like. And so we worked on scripts together for a few years, and eventually the story editors of the Jeffersons liked an episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show that we wrote on spec and invited us to come in and pitch story ideas for the Jeffersons. And we sold one, and that was the first thing that we ever sold. Who better than a couple of Jews to write the Jeffersons? And And that was how we got started. We did some freelance scripts after that for different shows, some shows you've never heard of. And then our agent was in the same agency as Gene Reynolds, who was the showrunner of MASH at the time. And he liked our Jefferson script and invited us to come in and pitch stories to MASH. And we sold one to him. And once we did MASH, we were pretty much on our way.
Okay. Now, you and your partner wrote the storyline for the send-off for Radar. Is that right?
Yeah, we wrote the script.
Now,
the story, we also wrote the dialogue. We wrote the script.
So it was just the two of you? It wasn't like what you see on, like, 30 Rock, where it's like a room full of writers and they're all...
You know, there are fewer writers on MASH. There are more shows nowadays have larger staffs. But no, there was, I would say, from the draft we turned in, I would say 95% of it is what you see on the screen.
That's really neat.
Now, writing for MASH, what a prestigious, great sitcom that was. As interesting as that is, for some reason, me personally, I'm oddly more interested in your experiences with After MASH.
Why?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's because failure is ultimately more interesting than success. I don't know what it is.
All right.
Nope.
All right. Ask me any question about After MASH.
Oh, okay. I want to know.
Whose idea was it to even, like, start this?
Larry Gelbart.
Well, yeah. Now
it was Larry Gelbart, the creator of MASH, and he sort of had an idea of how they could spin it off. And so since it was Larry Gelbart, and certainly MASH was, you know, quite the rage at the time, CBS just gave him a green light to go.
Now, was that a pleasurable experience for you trying to work?
You know what?
Work?
It actually was. It was very frustrating because we never really loved the show, and it was really a struggle writing it. But the people involved were great people, and getting a chance to work with Larry Gelbart is like being able to learn pitching from Sandy Koufax.
Yes.
And and it made us better writers, and it began a friendship and a working relationship with Larry that I maintain to this day, and it was worth it just for that.
Hmm. No, okay. Now, at the very end of the run of that show, I had read that they were about to be bringing in some of the old cast members for cameos or appearances.
You know,
they
wanted to all along. We did bring Gary Berghoff back for an episode. But, you know, Alan wasn't interested, and most of them had moved on. I remember at one point we were in a meeting with some executives from the studio, and somebody said, well, you know, you really should get Hot Lips to come in and do an episode. And I said, well, we checked with Loretta Swit, and she was doing other things, and she really wasn't interested in doing a cameo. And he said, well, it doesn't have to be Loretta Swit, just to be Hot Lips.
Oh.
I said, well, great, why don't we just get Diana Ross?
What a horrible idea that is.
Yeah. No, it doesn't have to actually be Loretta Swit. It could just be anyone and call her Hot Lips. And, you know, that will obviously get another 10 million people to watch.
That is so ridiculous because, I mean, at the time, the show must be already not doing well, and then someone comes up with such an idiotic idea. Hey, let's do the it would actually turn more people off.
Dan, I think maybe you should start calling me Hot Lips, and then we'll get more listeners.
I'll work on that.
That's right.
We could use a few.
You're doing a show with Hot Lips. Look, you know, the name could not hurt. How badly do you want ratings?
You have no idea. So, all right, from there you end up writing for Cheers for quite some time. Is that right?
Right, yeah, we were on Cheers for 9 years.
Now, it seems that you wrote every one of the episodes that featured Gary's Old Time Tavern.
Yes, we did the first one, the first Bar Wars. There are some episodes that we didn't write where Gary is involved, but all of the Bar Wars feud episodes we wrote.
You know, those are...
Which was about, like, six of them, I think. Like, once a season, we did one.
I love those. Those are among my favorites of the Cheers, because always the idea of that there's the opposite version, the bizarro version of whatever's going on, is always just funny to me.
Yeah, well, it was fun and kind of maddening, because each year we felt we had to have some new fun twist on it. Otherwise, it's just more of the same of just escalating practical jokes. So we kept looking for different clever ways of, you know, bending the form.
Well, you know, that leads into a perfect question, and this is something that Dan and I discuss a lot, how, you know, just being a creative person, a writer for a sitcom or a musical or music or anything like that, to me, it seems like it's so, I don't know, frustrating or frightening. Like, did you ever feel like the tap was running out and, like, just fear grip you when you were writing for shows?
That is a very good question. My partner and I did a series in 1985. We created a series for Mary Tyler Moore called Mary.
I remember that show.
It was a very difficult experience, and it really kind of burned us out. And when it was over, I was just, you know, kind of like shell-shocked and just needed a few months to just basically do nothing. And there was some concern that, yeah, what happens if I've just, you know, I've just burned out? And then the next season, you know, they called on Cheers and they said, you know, would you guys come back? And we thought, like, well, okay, let's see if we could do this. And we got, we worked out a story, and we got a script to do. It was actually a two-parter, the one where you introduce Eddie Lebeck, the hockey player, mm-hmm. you know, who Carla meets and eventually marries. And when we sat down to start writing the script that first day, and the flow came back and we were coming up with stuff and, you know, and able to make progress on the script, that's really when I felt, you know, we were, you know, out of danger, you know. It's like, you know, when they take the kryptonite away from Superman, you know, his powers start coming back. But that's really been the only time.
Wow.
So when you write for characters that you don't create, does that make it easier, or does that make it more difficult?
You know what? It depends on the character. You know, there are some characters. Well, case in point is MASH. I mean, you know, what better character to write is there than Hawkeye? And I didn't come up with that. On the other hand, you know, trying to be funny with Father Mulcahy is a difficult task.
Yeah.
So it really depends on the character.
I always wondered why Father Mulcahy was picked for Aftermath. It always seemed like such an odd choice to bring him along.
I think they took whoever wanted to go.
That, okay, that was what I figured. That's pretty much what I figured.
And he's a very nice guy. It's just that character is kind of limited.
Okay. True or false, Gary Berghoff, very difficult person?
No, not very difficult. There were times when he could be difficult, but, you know, then the next day, you know, he'd be fine. You know, he's a good guy. And believe me, if he were really that difficult, we never would have asked him back for Aftermath.
Gotcha.
You know, because to voluntarily bring back somebody who's a pain in the ass. You know, you got to be an idiot. So, no, Gary is fine.
Okay, now, moving on, you are involved with the most successful, well, you know what, I guess since you wrote an episode of The Jeffersons, it would be the most two successful spinoffs that I could personally think of. The Jeffersons and then with Frasier. And what was the experience like moving on? Like, was that a scary thing to you? You've already been with a failed spinoff with Aftermath, and here you were moving on with Frasier. Did you think that might, did any of those memories come back to you?
No, because Frasier is very clear that Kelsey Grammer could carry a show. I mean, he was very much a star. And when we didn't create the show, but again, we helped out and we were there for the pilot. And we had a run through before we actually filmed it, like 2 or 3 days before, we brought in an audience and just ran it for them just to get an idea of what worked, what didn't, let the cast for the first time get used to the idea of hearing laughter and how, you know, you have to pause and how it changes your timing, et cetera, et cetera. And it was clear from like 2 minutes into it that the audience was thrilled to see Frasier back and was really into the show. And I mean, I knew as a result of that, we all did, we knew before we ran 1 foot of film that that this show was going to be a hit.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's excellent. Excellent. All right. There's two things that I definitely have to ask you about. It's the two screenplays that I know you've written. One of them, Volunteers.
Right.
Where did Volunteers come from? Was that a pleasurable experience for you?
Volunteers was a very pleasurable experience, but it was the typical movie experience of draft after draft after draft, turnaround, new studio, new set of notes, new producer, new director, director drops out, movie goes into turnaround, new producer. So it went through that process, but we loved that character. And when we wrote it originally, the very first draft was 1980, and the movie was made in 1985. And at the time, the producer said, well, who do you think would be good for it? And we said, well, there's this guy on the show Bosom Buddies named Tom Hanks,
who we
really like. And they said, you know, get serious. You know, we can't let some, you know, TV sitcom guy who's, you know, 25 years old or whatever, you know, star in a movie like this. Anyway, we gave the, we were at the same agency as Tom at the time, and just for grins and giggles, we gave his agent a copy of the script, and we just were kind of curious, is this something Tom would even be interested in doing? And Tom loved it, but of course, you know, couldn't get a movie made. So now we flash forward, and it's 4 years later, and the movie has a director, and it's being set up, and this is like one of those true Hollywood stories, and Tom Hanks had just done Splash, and that was a big hit, and he was being offered everything in town, and he didn't like any of the scripts, and he said to his then agent, he had moved on, you know, there was a script I read about 4 or 5 years ago about a guy joining the Peace Corps that was like really funny. And whatever happened to that? And the agent said, well, I'll look into it, but, I mean, it's kind of a needle in a haystack. I'll see what I could do. And, I mean, this just sounds so impossible, but it's true. Like, an hour later, he gets a call from, you know, our studio saying, hey, we have a script we'd like Tom to consider. It's about a guy who joins the Peace Corps. And he said, he said, messenger it over to Tom right now. And he called Tom and said, you're not going to believe this, but I think I found the script. And
I single-handedly found it for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, because Thomas heard the story from us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, he gets the script, and he gets the script at like 4 o'clock, and he opens it up to like the middle, and he recognizes a scene, and he recognizes a specific joke that he had liked, and he said, yep, that's the one, and we got a call at 5:30 that afternoon that Tom Hanks was in, that the deal was closed.
That is so great.
Wow, that's a great story.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we didn't do any sort of beforehand talking, so I'm not really sure exactly how hard of a time we could give you regarding the other screenplay that you wrote. Can we be a little goofy with you there?
Oh, sure. Go ahead. God, you already brought up Aftermath. It's like, you know, why not just, you know, rip my heart out? Go ahead.
Okay. Now, here, I'm telling you, After MASH makes sense because you worked on MASH. Everything else that you have such a very, very stellar and impressive resume. Cheers, MASH, Frasier, a couple of episodes of The Simpsons. How on earth did you get roped into writing Mannequin on the Move?
Well, we got roped into it because we did a huge rewrite, even though it's uncredited, on Mannequin. We basically wrote Mannequin, the first one.
No.
Which made like $100 million or whatever it is.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so when they came out with a sequel, which was just god awful, but the original draft of Mannequin that we had to rewrite was equally awful. And so we did a rewrite on this one, and for reasons unbeknownst to me, they gave us shared credit for it, and it was just, you know, it was just terrible. it was just terrible.
So were you heavily involved with it, or
it doesn't seem like it? Not at all.
No.
Okay.
We spent 2 weeks. They gave us the script. We blasted through a draft. It's the same thing with Mannequin. We worked on it for 2 weeks and turned it in, and the next thing was we went to see the movie in a theater.
So, all right. Now,
so it's like they branded you with it.
So as you're going through working on Mannequin on the Move, and you've got to have
that's such a funny thing to say.
Oh, it's a wonderful title. I don't know what it really means. Do you know what it means, on the move?
I don't know what anything in that movie means.
Okay. Very good. Very good. And you have to, like, create essentially, like the same story, but it has two different characters.
Well, there has been a script. Like I said, there was a script.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And we just rewrote it and took out the real offensive Nazi jokes and stuff like that. But, I mean, story was pretty much in place.
Oh, okay.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So we can't even tease you that much about it then.
Well, you're welcome to try.
I don't know. I'm kind of having fun talking about it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, so. I directed a series a number of years ago. It was on ABC called Brother's Keeper, starring Billy Ragsdale, and he's the guy who was the star of Mannequin.
Yes, Mannequin on the Move. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So I went up to him the first day, and I just said, "Oh my God, how did you? That was the worst movie. What were you thinking? what were you thinking?"
Wow,
And he was like, "Well, yeah, I know it really wasn't that good, but you know, I mean, it wasn't that." I said, "No, it was really terrible. It was like a really, you know, terrible script." And I said, "And I should know because I'm one of the writers."
That's so great.
Okay. Next thing I got to ask you about is two episodes of The Simpsons. What's it like writing for The Simpsons? Because that seems like
It seems like you go, like you're walking into the Mad Magazine crazy, you know.
Yeah, where just things are bouncing
bananas,
off the walls.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It was really fun writing The Simpsons because there is so much freedom in animation. You know, you can put Homer in Yankee Stadium filled with 50,000 people just as easily as you can put him in a dining room. So we really enjoyed that aspect of it. Plus, I got to do a voice in one of the episodes. That was really cool.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's really neat.
Ah, you're even cooler than I realized, Ken. Nice work. Okay. Tell me about Ken Levine's sitcom room.
Well, it's a writing seminar that I started along with another partner, Dan O'Day. And, you know, I've been doing a blog, which is kenlevine.blogspot.com. I notice you guys haven't plugged it, so I guess I'll have to do it myself.
Oh. Plug as much as you'd like.
Jeez, you know, okay. We can't do all the heavy lifting, Ken. Come on.
Okay. I've always wanted, I enjoy in the blog giving writing advice, and I always wanted to do some kind of writing course, but I always wanted it to be something different than just a talking head standing up there lecturing on writing. And so I came up with the idea of the sitcom room, which basically simulates what the experience is like being in a comedy writing room. And so what I do is I have 20 students and break them up into four groups of five, and we spend Saturday morning really briefing them on how you break down a scene and what to look for and the various tools and that sort of thing. And then I bring in four actors, and they perform a scene of a real bad sitcom scene that I wrote for the occasion. And then they go off to their writing rooms and they have to rewrite it. It's about a 10-minute scene. And then the next day, the actors come back and do their scenes. And so it's really a chance to have a hands-on experience. And it's one thing to write a script and have somebody just read it and critique it and say, this doesn't work, and that's pretty funny, and this is extraneous. And it's another to actually see your work being performed by professional actors. And the actors that I have are all sitcom veterans. They've either starred in sitcoms or have done an awful lot of work. So they're very professional actors. And it's great because, you know, when you're a writer and you're trying to make it in the industry, how often do you get a chance to actually see your stuff come alive? How often do you have a chance to see it performed in front of an audience to really see which jokes work and which jokes didn't and why? So it's a real good experience for them. And then we have like an all-star panel I put together of current sitcom writers.
Oh, wow.
Talking about, you know, the business, because the other thing that they all want to know is, how do you get agents? What's the business like?
Right, right, right.
How do you get on staff? Things like that. So we cover that. So it's a very intensive two-day program. By the time it's over at 5 o'clock on Sunday, they're all exhausted. So I've done my job.
Do you recall, you know, just being blown away by like is it like, oh, everybody's so wonderful, or is it like, wow, there was this one guy who was so great in that 10-minute scene, he just blew me away? Or,
you know, it wasn't. No, there was nobody that you just went, whoa. But there are teams, and we kind of put the teams together sort of at random. But there were teams that did a better job than other teams. The thing that I was most impressed with is that all of them did a very good job, that all of them really took to heart, you know, the lectures on how to make it work and why certain things work. And then when they used those principles and another 20 people were laughing at the jokes, at the scene, they could see, like, oh, wow, it really does work. But I would say in each of the scenes, there were either some good ideas that weren't realized or some really good jokes. Mm-hmm. Maybe it kind of fell apart, or maybe it started slow or something like that. But all of the scenes were really good. And that was my one big fear, honestly, is that someone would, some team would do a scene and the actors would do it and it would just be death. It would just be horrible. But that wasn't the case.
Well,
and there were no fist fights. That's the other thing I thought, you know, that you put five people together sort of at random. You know, you're going to have a couple of people that become fast friends, and then you're going to have some people who want to kill each other.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We didn't have anyone want to kill each other. So that was that was really nice. In fact, I've done this twice, and the first time I did it, that group of 20 has like a, I don't know, like a Yahoo chat group or something like that. And they've all remained friends, and they all continue to correspond with each other and pass around scripts to each other and use each other as a support group. So that's pretty cool.
That's great. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like a baseball fantasy camp for sitcom writers.
Yeah, that's kind of what it is.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. Are you doing
another one
of those?
No one snaps a hamstring.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Do you have one of those coming up?
Sitcomroom.com. Plug that, too.
Yes.
I'm going to do another one in the fall, hopefully. It's tough during baseball season because I'm the host of Dodger Talk on their flagship station, KBC, so I have to be involved with every Dodger game.
Wow, that's a lot of games.
Ken, why are all the teams in the National League West pretty much under 500?
You know what? I think because they all have young players, and everyone expected the young players to all blossom and that, you know, each team had tomorrow's superstar, and I think all of these kids are progressing at a much slower rate than everyone had hoped. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Dodgers, we have just been decimated by injuries, just decimated. So that's been a big problem for us.
So when you were growing up, what team were you a fan of?
Dodgers.
Okay, so now you're in the dream spot.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I know you worked for the Mariners, and you said before you worked for Baltimore. Is it?
Yeah, I worked for Baltimore, I worked for the Mariners, and I worked for the Padres. And in the American League, I still have a strong allegiance to the Mariners.
Okay, now all right, here's a question. Because you worked for the Padres, you grew up a Dodger fan. Padres are right down the road, maybe a little – you got – I don't know. How big is that rivalry, would you say? Is that big at all?
You know, it's a big rivalry in San Diego. It's not a big rivalry in L.A.
See, all right, that's exactly what, if I had to have guessed, that's exactly how I would have guessed it would work out. Working for the Padres, because, you know, you're calling the games, you're around the guys, but, you know, somewhere in you, you're still a Dodger fan. Is there any kind of emotional conflict that you feel calling those kinds of games?
You know, just slightly. When I was with the Padres, you know, it's like I root for the team that pays me.
Right.
And I got to know the guys, and so you're rooting for the individuals. You want to see the individuals succeed. But it was kind of tough sometimes when we'd be playing a game at Dodger Stadium and Mike Piazza would hit a big home run, and the crowd was going crazy, and I would have to really remember that I'm calling the game for the right. other side.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm not thrilled about Piazza hitting a three-run bomb in the ninth inning. So, yeah, that was a little tough. On the other hand, I figure, you know what, since I like both of the teams, it's like I can't lose.
Yeah, I see that. I always think about jobs like that, like the announcers, you know, being a Mets fan. If I had to call for the Braves and then I'm watching, you know, I don't know, like, I don't know that I could do it. I would have to, like, I guess you just look in your bank account and that when it goes ahead and makes everything okay, right?
Yeah. You know what? You just become a professional.
Right.
And that's the team you're with. You know, as a fan, as a Dodger fan, I've always hated the Giants. On the other hand, you know, the guy who is now their lead announcer, John Miller, was my partner in Baltimore. We're real good friends. The manager of the Giants is Bruce Bochy, who used to be the manager of the Padres when I was there. We're good friends. He brought Tim Flannery and all of his coaches.
Uh-huh,
I know some of the players. So when the Giants come to town, it's like, a reunion with me. You know, I know all of the guys, and they're all good guys. But, you know, in my heart, it's like, oh, the Giants.
Ah, you guys are great. That's just except for those awful uniforms you're wearing. What are you doing? Right. Okay.
So, I mean, you find you hate the fans more than you hate the actual team.
See, yes, absolutely. And in San Francisco, do they throw in batteries? Is that true? They chuck batteries there?
Yeah, I think they do, and all that beat LA crap and everything. Just, you know, it's envy.
Exactly.
It's envy.
That makes perfect sense to me. All right, so you're definitely going to do another Ken Levine sitcom room, right?
I'm not definitely, but I'm probably going to do it, reasonably sure. But we haven't, you know, nailed it down, set the date, you know, booked the hotel. But we're looking towards doing that.
All right, if maybe my wife will let me go out there. I'm gonna try to.
Hey,
work
we
on
had
that.
Somebody from Germany. We had somebody from Amsterdam. I've had people from Toronto, from Boston, Cincinnati.
That's great.
Yeah, that is
Seattle.
Great.
I mean, they came from all over the world.
See that? Everybody wants to be a sitcom writer.
Now, that's right.
Right here on our little light bulb internet radio station, we are in the process of working on a online radio sitcom. So I just one last question for you, Ken. What's the one piece of advice you would have for writing a sitcom that I could pass on?
I would say make it character driven. That what really works the best in sitcoms is humor that comes out of the characters as opposed to just writing jokes.
Gotcha. Jessica, don't write jokes, write characters.
All right.
You got it?
Right.
Yes.
And if you write good characters and you put the characters in funny situations, the jokes will come.
Yes. Yes. See? Situation.
How do you feel about
comedy? Situation
how do you feel
comedy.
About, like, narration?
I think it's kind of overused, and I think narration is a way of being very lazy.
Oh, wow.
Because it just explains away exposition as opposed to artfully having to dole it out.
I so agree with you.
Jessica's like there, nodding her head and grinning at me. Wow. All right.
Why, you like narration?
It depends on what it is, but sometimes I do. I guess,
He's a hack, though.
But I am a hack. That's absolutely true. Everyone knows that I'm, well, not everyone.
Right.
Ken doesn't know.
I mean, like Sex in the City, you know, and then Samantha went out with him and found out that he really was a creep and was so upset that she bought a lot of clothes. And you're going, well, why don't we just see what the character does, you know, when she's upset, you know?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
So true. Yes. So true.
Ken, let me ask you, what do you think about the current state of television these days, specifically when it comes to sitcoms?
I think we're in a real dry period in sitcoms.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there are sitcoms on there that I watch and
do you
I,
hate Two and
I
a Half
enjoy.
Men?
What?
Do you hate Two and a Half Men?
Yes.
Me too!
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
That was the right answer.
I have to cook you dinner, I think.
Yeah.
Jessica, are there any other shows that you hate that you want to ask Ken
no,
just to get his approval?
That's
the main one. That's the main offender these days.
I mean, to me, that show is just a lot of penis jokes, and it doesn't take an awful lot of art or skill to me to write something like that. But I watch The Office and enjoy it,
and I watch
30 Rock and enjoy it.
That's another great one. Yeah.
You know, mostly what I watch is dramas, though. I think we're, like, in a golden age of TV dramas.
I know, like, my TiVo, my head's going to explode with all the actual shows I do TiVo, but none of them are sitcoms anymore, except for Thursday night, NBC, it seems.
Right.
I mean, even Earl, I'm like, eh.
Yeah.
Now, these days, we're just inundated with the reality shows, and it seems like the percentage of real estate that they're taking on the TV schedule is getting bigger and bigger all the time. Do you see this changing at any time in the future, or is this just the way that television is going?
No, I see it changing when audiences stop watching. And I think that's starting to happen. I think there is a saturation.
Oh,
and I think even the shows that are really big hits are starting to show their age, like Survivor and American Idol. I mean, I, used to love American Idol, and I would critique it each week in my blog and everything. And I don't know, this year there was just sort of a sameness to it. And I didn't really love it as much. So I just have a feeling that, these shows have, like everything else, just a certain period where they jump the shark and people aren't as interested. And the problem with reality shows is they have no shelf life. You know, if you have a hit series like Friends, when Friends finishes its run, you have 200 episodes that you can sell into syndication and sell for $1 billion. But no one's going to buy American Idol episodes, and no one's going to buy Survivor,
wow.
And no one's going to buy The Bachelorette. So, they just get, their one-time, hit with these shows.
That is a great point. I never even thought of that.
And why is it now that we've moved into a summer season, whereas it used to be you would get just reruns in the summer, and that was okay. But now, there's The Greatest American Dog that's on, and all of these awful America's Got Talent and things like that are coming out. How do we move back to the reruns, Ken?
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one, because networks are putting up shows on the internet, seeing a rerun is not as big a deal. Used to be, if you missed the episode the first time around, the only way you could see it was when it came back around in the summer. Well, now if you miss an episode of 30 Rock, you can just go to NBC.com and watch it.
You plug your 42-inch HDTV into your computer, and you get to even watch it that way.
Yeah, so I think that's part of it. Number two, reality shows are cheap, and occasionally one might become a big hit. remember American Idol and Survivor were both summer shows.
Mm.
So I think they're looking to see if they can, you know, find lightning in a bottle one more time.
Is it okay that I root against the greatest American dog?
No. No. I hope when people look back at that show that that's how they refer to it in terms of their critique.
Okay, good. Because how did that thing get away from the Animal Planet channel? How did that get on a network television? That doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, Ken, thank you so much for spending just about the entire hour with us. I do appreciate you spending some time
great.
With us.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
All right, and everybody, just remember, kenlevine.blogspot.com. And what's the one for the sitcom room that I'm going to go to? And
sitcomroom.com.
Sitcomroom.com. Easy
now,
enough.
I hope you replay this show like 5,000 times, right?
You got it. We get actually
get it on a podcast.
Yes, and then it's downloadable
replays.
On a podcast, so you're covered.
Fantastic. Well, hello to your billions of listeners.
Yes, our billions of listeners. Anyway, thanks for joining us, Ken. Have a good one.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Bye, Ken.
All right, everybody. Ken Levine. Sitcom, a superstar writer. Ken Levine.
That was phenomenal.
Worked on all kinds of programs that I could only wish that I had worked on. But maybe if I go to the sitcom school, I will have that one day. How much do you think it costs?
I don't even want to know.
Because that's the thing. I was thinking about asking him, but then I said,
no.
I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't mind saying he's going to have to put it out there anyway. But then you find out it's like 10 grand or something.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that doesn't include hotel and airfare and meals.
And not including lunch.
Exactly. And you know the most expensive thing is going to be the damn lunch.
Yes.
Yes. Anyway. Jessica, we are running out of time here, which might not be a bad thing. But let's
Running or runned?
Running. We got a couple minutes. We're okay. I just want to touch on a few things real quick, okay?
Uh-huh.
I just want to get your opinion on things. Speed Racer. Huge flop in the movies, right?
Yeah.
Biggest flop that we've had all year long, and it's not even close.
Uh-huh.
Even Meet Dave and the Love Guru can look at Speed Racer and feel better about themselves.
Yes.
Now, Warner Brothers is thinking, hey, maybe DVD.
Yeah.
Maybe it finds a life on DVD. What do you think of that?
Okay. I agree. I think that, first of all, what else do they have? They have nothing else. Second of all, there are so many things that find a better life on DVD. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
I mean,
right. I'll be honest.
Pack it full of crap and have it released really big. You know, spend some extra dollars marketing it.
Wow. See, you are doing exactly what Warner Brothers has already decided to do, because they're going to have a big DVD push for this movie. They're going to have not just a 2-disc special edition. It's going to be a 3-disc. And it's going to have all kinds of things that you really don't need, but maybe you'll see that commercial and you'll say, oh, I need that! You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I say, you're already like $1 billion in the hole. What's another couple million? Go ahead, throw it at it.
No.
What's wrong with throwing good money after bad?
You don't think that if they spend a little bit of extra on getting the DVD out there that people won't buy it? People are DVD crazy.
No. I think it's a great idea. I think they're at the point where they're so pot committed on this movie with what they've spent.
But
yes, make the push.
It sounds like you were saying, no, throw another $2 million in the bottomless pit.
It may be in the bottomless pit. You are taking that gamble. But I think once you've gone ahead and you already gambled away the house, right?
What's the trash cans?
Right. What's the outhouse? Go ahead. Throw that in there too, because maybe you make something up. Maybe you get double or nothing and you hit a little bit. So anyway, you can look forward to that coming out, probably in the next couple of months, because hell, probably like next week, because you know the damn DVDs these days.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember how long in the 1980s it took for a movie to come out on home video?
No, I was not, you know, hep on that.
That's why I hate the age difference between us. It's only 5 years, folks, but I'm telling you, it's like
it's
a
like
lifetime
almost
away.
6 years.
No, that's not true, because you know what, come 827... Little Miss 827 will only be 4 years apart.
Oh, okay.
See, you catch up to me. I don't get further away from you. It doesn't work that way. as much as you might like to think that it does.
It's actually like 7 years. In like regular years, like what you're talking about is like dog years. In normal people years, it's like 8 years. You're older than me.
All right, thanks. Anyway, we are out of time here on the Radio Dan Show. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow, going over some new movies that are coming out. Jessica will cry on air as we discuss Fantasy Moguls and how she's hopelessly not going to win anything.
No.
What?
That's not true. I'm still in it.
Did you see? Did you see the update today? Did you see where you are?
Where am I?
You're like seventh.
It's okay.
And by the way, your little box office thing, I passed you. Bye-bye. I've passed you in box office. You bragged about it for months. When I say months,
no
I mean like 6 weeks. Yeah, I'm ahead of you. Isn't that amazing how that happens?
How many movies do you have coming out?
I have one more.
All right, I've got two more.
Yes. Hold on to your space chimps, or as I like to call it, Meet Dave 2 for you. Anyway, stick around. Live test show is coming up. And say goodnight, Jessica.
Good night, Jessica.
Yamma, 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 yamma. Whoopie doo, Scooby doo, and gobbledygook.